Folks, why don't we get started this morning? We have a full agenda and a very tight timeframe because we have competing committee meetings going on. And since we're not doing this just for the tape, we really want the members of the conference committee to actually hear the important testimony. We're going to try to get what we can in before 9:30 is when we're thinking there may be a need to start breaking up, and what we can't get done at this point, we'll reconvene later in the day to finish up. Representative Kahn?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for considering our committee's conflict schedules, but just in case we're still going on, I have two points that I want to make strongly at the outset as we consider this issue, two things that I would like us to think of as we're dealing with the framework of the bill. The first one, and there are obviously things that are in the House bill and not in the Senate bill. And the first, I'm not going to give all the arguments and everything, but the first one is I think it's very important for the double Article 1, Article 2 structure of the House bill. The fact that we're setting out some permanent language that means if something like this, which we of course hope will never happen again, ever happens again, the first thing we can say to the victims, you know, maybe even as they're going to the hospital, is the state has you in mind and there's a framework and we'll be able to hook into that framework. I think that would have been incredibly useful if that Article 1 had been in place at the time that we had the special session dealing with the floods, which we knew how to take care of because we have done lots of things for natural disasters. And it's not saying it doesn't take effect unless you do the step in Article 2, which is the legislature declares that it's a catastrophe. The second thing, and I know this is a real divergence from the, well, they're both divergences from the Senate position, I think is extremely important, is that, and I think it's important in light of the testimony we're going to hear today, is that we get as far away from the claims process as we can. The claims process does not, which works fine for what the ordinary things that go on in the state, that have bad things that have gone on in the state through 150 years, but it doesn't work for something like this. And I think the further we move away from the claims process, the less we have to answer arguments about how do we answer the fact that we're treating this person differently than that person. A catastrophe will be different than an ordinary tort claim, and a catastrophe will only occur when a legislature, and we're not binding the hands of future legislatures, makes the determination that it's a catastrophe. And I will easily say we're looking at 182, I guess, is the number of victims. You know, that's a number that's a catastrophe to me. If someone wants to talk about 3 or 6 or something like that, victims, that may be very bad for those people. But I don't think that's a catastrophe by what we're looking at. Someone else will decide if 50, 30, 60, and so forth is a catastrophe. So those are the two, that's all I'm going to say right now, those are the two factors that I think are really important in our construction of the final bill.
Representative Kahn, we'll consider that the House's opening statement with regard to your position on the bill. Suffice it to say there's great concern on the Senate side regarding putting a permanent structure in place that would open the floodgates, if you will, from our perspective, every time there's a problem in the state, a bill introduced to deal with it outside of the traditional framework. And the only other thing I'll say is that you can't declare something a non-tort simply by declaring it to be so because of the numbers of people that were involved. You can't change the character of the event or the cause of the event. Let's leave it at that for now. What I'd like to do, for everyone's information, we've got until about 9:30, we're going to make a little adjustment in the agenda to respect the fact that we'll probably have to reconvene later in the day. And there are some folks for whom it will be a greater challenge to return later in the day. But I do want to set out, before we go any further, some of the philosophical premise for the Senate position. I've said this before the Senate and before the Senate committees that heard this, But I think it's important for the House members to understand how we came to the position that we did. And it wasn't random, and it wasn't knee-jerk, but it was based on principles and the existing framework of state tort law. So let me just sort of explain that premise. We're all acting from the premise that no amount of dollars will ever make people whole for this, but we're left with what we have, which is in terms of claims, dollars. But the premise is that we live in a system of laws of general applicability so that people in the same situations are treated basically the same. Government acts without favor, not arbitrarily but consistently, so that citizens have confidence that they are getting the same treatment that the last person in the same situation did and that the next person in the same situation will. If not this system, then government acts are random, arbitrary, rife with favoritism, everyone looking for the exception to the application of the statute, thereby eviscerating the value of the rule of law. This is a question of fundamental government fairness toward all of its citizens. Make no mistake about it, we are making long-term public policy here. And the exceptions that we make to existing law will have long-term precedent. Now, the bridge collapse was indeed unique in some ways. It was unique in the scope, the number of people who died and were injured in one incident. It was unique in the way it pierced the consciousness of everyone. Because it made us conscious of our vulnerability to a risk that we had not really thought of. Driving across a bridge felt more dangerous on August 2 than it did on July 31st. And I'm sure I certainly imagined ourselves on the bridge and what it would have been like, although we could never really understand it because we didn't go through it. This, of course, led to massive media coverage throughout the world. For a variety of reasons, the dramatic pictures, the number of injuries, the loss of life, the rescue efforts, it made for a lot of media coverage. And certainly that filled our hearts with compassion. But analytically, if you break it down, I think it really is no different than any other negligence case. We can't put findings in the legislation to say any different that would change the facts. The civil lawsuits written by the lawyers for the victims will say the same basic things that any tort claim against the state says, that the state had a duty of care to those who used the bridge, that the state needed to exercise a standard of care in taking care of the bridge, that the state deviated from that standard of care, causing injuries to the plaintiffs. Those are the essential elements of any tort complaint. And those will be the essential elements of any claim against the state brought in court arising out of the bridge collapse. Now, given the circumstances, the state does face significant legal exposure, which I think makes it a fair reason for the state to step up to the plate early rather than waiting 5 or 6 years for litigation to go through and for the case to go up to the Supreme Court once or twice. That said, I also believe that compensating the survivors and the families of the victims of the deceased is the right thing to do on a moral basis as well. But if we believe in the rule of law and its non-arbitrary application, then we must deliver compensation in a way that does not undermine the premise of the statutes that govern it if we were to take no special action. To completely ignore the current statutory scheme of liability caps for government would be unfair to our constituents who will be paying the bill, unfair to the taxpayers, unfair to those who benefit from other government programs that get paid for out of the state budget, unfair to those who have been hurt in the past by government action, and unfair to those who will be hurt in the future. And when I say unfair, I also mean inequitable. And when I say those who are hurt in the future, I say those who might be injured by government action or inaction in some future event. For example, and we'll hear a little more about this in the testimony probably this afternoon, when Drew Shadeen brought a claim against the state for wrongful death, she settled at the state tort cap in effect at the time of $300,000. Now, we don't like to put values on life, but that was the value that was placed on her life in terms of a claim against the state, because that's the state law that applied. So how do we turn to the family of Drew Shadeen and tell them that her life was worth less than the family of someone who died on the bridge, who might, under a different scheme, get $1 million or $2 million, or in a private claim, get far more? But how do we tell them that their life is worth less than the life of someone who fell on the bridge simply because her death didn't occur on the bridge? Similarly, if a state patrol officer were to injure a pedestrian or another motorist in a high-speed chase, suffer exactly the same injuries that some of the most seriously injured on the bridge suffer, how do we tell that family or that person that their injuries are worth only $400,000 if it were to happen today? And no matter what their medical expenses or other suffering is, but tell them if they had suffered those injuries on the bridge, they'd be entitled to $1 million or $2 million under an uncapped compensation scheme. The same issue would apply to any government action, city, county, or school districts that cause injury, because the same principle of liability caps applies to all government agencies in Minnesota. We're dealing with tens of millions of dollars here. One reason we are is because both proposals choose to not apply the aggregate cap that applies, and there's, I think, fair reason for that. But we're in a severe budget situation this year. In a zero-sum budget, which is what we're operating under, every dollar that goes here does not go into our schools, does not go into roads or bridges, does not go into LGA to reduce property taxes or to offset some of the increases that might result, depending on how the budget gets handled this year, does not go into early childhood programs. The day the budget forecast came out, I was talking to a group of homeless advocates, and I had to tell them that, you know, we're probably not going to be able to do anything to offset the utility bill increases because of the oil prices or the foreclosure issues because of the economy, and there's just some things we can't do because we don't have any money this year. But every dollar that goes into this does not go into that. How much we need for this bill will depend in part on the parameters we set for determining the levels of individual compensation. We should also be aware that the state is not likely the only source of compensation here. There are several parties who will be claimed to be at fault and who may also end up paying survivors or the families of those who died. Third-party tortfeasors is a technical term for it, whether it's a consultant, whether it was a contractor, or someone else that we haven't heard of yet. So the state does not need to feel compelled to shoulder 100% of the compensation responsibility here. I think the Senate's proposal is a narrowly tailored, balanced, moderate approach, recognizing the competing concerns here. Let me just say one word in addition about the aggregate cap, which is that this is unique in the number of injuries or deaths that resulted in one incident. And applying the $1 million aggregate cap would, in my judgment, compress the individual recovery down to pennies, just pennies on the dollar, which I don't think that the legislature contemplated that when they passed the aggregate cap at the level that it's at. But no, in my judgment, no similar principle can apply to the individual cap, because the pressure on the individual cap would be the loss of life or the uncompensated or the medical expenses or wage loss, all things which occur anytime there is a physical injury resulting from action or inaction of another party. So that's the premise, so that the House members have a better understanding of how the Senate arrived at the position that we did. That said, the individual cap was raised from $300,000 to $400,000 in the Senate bill. $300,000 was the law that applied at the time, so a 33% increase. And part of the justification is for that is that it was scheduled to go up anyway January 1st by previous law to $400,000. So, but for the passage of 5 months, there's that difference of $100,000. Also, the Senate bill wraps in municipal liability for the city of Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota. So to the extent there is any legal exposure on those parties, That is also covered by any releases from those who opt into the tort to the compensation fund. So that it seemed to make sense to increase the amount of fund available under the individual cap from that standpoint as well. So that said, why don't we turn to the formal agenda for today. We're going to make some adjustments, as I said, out of respect to the some of the individuals who would have difficulty coming back later this afternoon. So we're going to start with Tom Grundhofer from the League of Minnesota Cities, who's usually or often around the Capitol but has another commitment this afternoon. And he's going to be speaking on behalf of Tom, go ahead and have a seat. On behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities, the Minnesota Association of Townships, the Minnesota School Boards Association, and the Minnesota Inter-County Association, all of whom are signatories on a letter that has been, I believe, delivered or distributed to each member of the conference committee. Mr. Grundhofer, welcome to the conference committee. Can you state your name for the record and tell us what you have to say?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and my name is Tom Grundhofer. I'm the general counsel with the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you for having us here to talk about this very important issue. I'm here today to discuss a very limited aspect of this legislation, really specifically whether or not there should be a per-person limitation included in the final legislation. As Senator Latz mentioned, you will have received a letter from us yesterday supported by the School Boards Association, the Township Association, and the County Intergovernmental Association, stating a preference for legislation that does include a cap. So in that respect, we are supporting the Senate version of the legislation. You might ask initially why local governments are concerned about this issue and why we really stick our neck into this matter. The answer is simply that any legislation that affects the integrity and the defensibility of the state tort liability limits can have and probably will have an impact on the local government liability limits. Over the years, the League of Cities and other local government associations have supported the concept of liability limits for the state and local governments as a legitimate means of ensuring the long-term financial stability of both the state and local government finances. In fact, just 2 years ago, we and other local government associations supported efforts to increase the tort liability limits in an effort to ensure that they remained both appropriate and reasonable. We were actually the impetus for the changes in the tort liability limits just a couple years ago. Now, while we believe there is rationale to support both the House and Senate versions of the legislation, we believe the Senate version, which includes a cap, offers greater defensibility. Now, while the unprecedented nature of this event resembles in many ways a natural disaster in both its impact and scope, based really on the facts as it's developed to date, I think the better argument is really stated by Senator Latz that this incident more closely resembles a tort. Given this and the rationale to treat and the point that it really makes sense to treat victims of this incident in substantially the same manner as those affected by other government actions, we prefer legislation that includes a liability limitation. Now, when this legislation in both houses was introduced, we were generally concerned about the potential impact on the tort liability limits. But it really wasn't until Senator Latz's bill was introduced that the effect on the tort limits was really explicitly included in the legislation. Accordingly, once that issue was squarely on the table, we thought we needed to weigh in on the matter. Frankly, we have concerns from a liability limit standpoint with both the House and Senate versions, but for the following reasons, we really prefer the Senate version. First and foremost, it includes a cap, which ultimately helps support the concept and rationale for liability limits generally. Now, second, while we retroactive adjustment to the state tort limits is not our preferred approach, we believe that action is justified because, quite frankly, when the January 1, 2008 date was set to go into effect, it was established in order to give local governments adequate time to procure insurance at the higher levels. That same argument really doesn't apply to the state. And apparently the state is not aware of really any significant number of claims that would be affected by the adjustment other than the bridge victims' claims. So the move back to August 1 of 2007 really doesn't create any particularly bad precedent for local governments or, I believe, the state. Third, we are not overly concerned with the disparity between the state and municipal limits for that limited period of time between August 1 and 2008 because we think it is reasonable to believe the state is in a better position to respond to unanticipated and uninsured adjustments to the exposure than our local governments, who simply don't have the same tax base over which to spread that same risk. Really, for these reasons, the League of Cities and the other local government associations group listed on our letter prefer the Senate version. We know this is a very difficult issue, a tough issue, but as Senator Latz talked about, in order to really sustain the rule of law, we believe you have to keep the concept of caps in place. And we'd urge you to do so. I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Grundhofer. Are there any questions from the conference committee? Representative Winkler.
Representative Simon, go ahead first.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grundhofer, thank you. Both in your oral testimony just now and in your letter, you talk about the viability and defensibility of the caps, and you mentioned precedent. Obviously, there are two kinds of precedent. One is legal precedent, and one is just the precedent that we set around here, formally or informally. Could you tell us with a little more specificity, are you worried that there is, I mean, without giving away the exit for someone wishing to challenge the caps, are you really worried that this creates the possibility that, legally speaking, this opens up a legal argument for someone to bust up the caps? And the second question is, are you then also concerned just about precedent in the less formal sense, that by the legislature doing, let's say, the House version of the bill, that it sets a precedent in the informal sense for doing it later? Which sense of the word precedent do you mean? And I'm particularly concerned on the first issue whether you mean that there's a legal argument here, that this creates an actual legal precedent or an opening for a legal argument.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Grundhofer.
Representative Simon, our primary concern is the legal precedent issue. Well, I think there are good rationale that can be put forward for the House version of the bill. I have a difficult time explaining from a legal precedent standpoint why somebody who is injured on the bridge should receive more than somebody who is injured, severely injured, because of an accident that occurs on a state highway or a state bridge anywhere else in the state because of some potentially inadequately maintained highway or bridge. That is, frankly, our more significant concern. I think there are all kinds of reasons why this is a very unique situation, and so I'm less concerned about sort of the general precedent, because I think you can point to a lot of factors in that regard, but I am concerned about the legal precedent issue.
Representative Winkler? Simon, I'm sorry.
Thank you. I'm the better half of St. Louis Park.
That's right.
He's the lesser half.
Yeah. I've lived in both halves, so I can't say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Grundhofer, I guess I would just say this is more of a comment than anything. I think that, you know, we hear a lot around here about slippery slope arguments, and there may be some legal precedent. I can't claim to have reviewed the cases and what opening there might be for someone to argue that the caps are smashed now because we did something differently. But I'm a little wary sometimes about slippery slope arguments, that if we do one thing, it'll inevitably lead down the road to something else, because we draw lines around here all the time, every single day, on almost every single bill. And we make decisions that are, I wouldn't say arbitrary. I'd like to think we're more thoughtful than that. But that set precedents, small p precedents. And so we're in the business of line drawing all the time. So I don't think that the fact that we do one thing for one set of people means we are drawn like into a magnetic force field beyond our control, that we're drawn and compelled to do something. We cast votes all the time and we draw lines all the time. I just want to be mindful of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, let me just comment briefly on that. Several years ago, there was a distinction in the law between some liability protections that the state had and liability protections that local governments had. And you could say that the legislature had come up with, you know, very good rationale for those distinctions. But the courts basically said that at least in that situation, we couldn't make a logical policy reason why a victim of a state tort should be treated one way and the victim of a local government tort should be treated another way. So again, I understand your point, but the courts do sort of pay attention to those sort of equal protection concerns.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Grunhofer, are you, and this is a question I don't know the answer to, are you aware of the previous occurrence of, or decision by the state to waive the occurrence cap, the total aggregate occurrence cap in any particular situation?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Grunhofer.
Representative Winkler, I am not aware of a previous incident of the state waiving that, but there are countless state tort claims that get settled out of court, and they may or may not have been resolved beyond the per occurrence cap. I just don't know that. The state risk manager would probably have a better idea of that.
Mr. Chair, follow up. How about an occurrence where the state has retroactively changed the individual cap in response to a particular incident?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I do not know whether they've done that before.
Okay. And Mr.
Chair, Representative Winkler.
I guess the question then is, if we're taking legislative action to change a particular individual cap retroactively, and we are making a decision to change the total occurrence cap in response to a particular occurrence, isn't there then a strong legal argument that a creative trial attorney could make that the legislature really doesn't have a strong rational basis for the cap structure at all? And in fact, isn't there considerable risk in doing what the Senate bill would do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, having dealt with creative trial lawyers many times over the years, they can certainly make those arguments, and I suspect they will, and I would not quantify that. You said strong arguments, compelling arguments. I think there's great deference given to legislative decision-making, and I think the decision to waive the per-occurrence cap in this catastrophic, widespread, numerous victims sort of situation is more than justified and defensible. The decision to retroactively adjust the cap back to August 1, I think, can be defended again because, as I mentioned, I don't think there are a number of other state claimants that reach that level. And I think, again, the unique nature of this and the fact that you're not affecting a lot of other potential claimants is a defensible position.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Mr. Grunhofer, how do you come down on one side or another? Under the House version of the bill, we're essentially making a legislative finding that existing state law, policy, and precedent doesn't really exist that would adequately address this situation and seeks to create a one-off remedy, if you will, for this unique situation. The Senate bill then tries to, for its part, it tries to adjust in a more kind of modest basis, but directly in the statute, change the state liability cap structure. How do you determine which is entails more legal risk for the state and local governments in the future? How do you know which approach would be riskier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, that's just best judgment. I think arguments can be made both ways, and they probably will be made both ways. We represent over 800-some local government units. We're involved in tort cases every day. We see these type of facts. We've worked on tort caps and adjustments and the rationale for tort caps for years. It's just our best judgment that the Senate version probably is more defensible. But, again, I think your bill has its strong arguments to support it.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, make one comment in response to
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Grunhofer's statement and yours, which is that we are dealing with the rule of law and equal treatment. And if we are dealing with the comparison with Drew Shadeen, we, I suppose, in that case would have to ask
Why wouldn't we go back retroactively, or why didn't we go back at some after that event occurred and change the individual cap and increase it? Because that is what we were doing. And under both, I guess my point is that under both bills, we're taking exceptional action because we recognize, whether it's analytical, emotional, or otherwise, that this is an unprecedented and very unique event that occurred that doesn't fit within existing state liability or other disaster response or any other kind of legal structure. And it's difficult, I think, to claim that one bill versus another is particularly more consistent with existing state law because we are making exceptions. And I think that, I don't know about all of us, but as far as I know, all of us think that that is necessary as a result of this.
Any further questions? Representative DeLaForest.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Grundhofer, I'll admit at the outset, I'm certainly not an expert on insurance, but when we talk about what we're doing here, either with the House or the Senate language, I'm curious with respect to insurance. Insurance, in large part, is about trying to assess future risk and looking into the future. And I'm wondering, by taking any action here today, when it comes to modeling insurance, are we injecting a degree of risk or uncertainty into future modeling that may increase premiums because there becomes a greater risk of uncertainty with respect to what might happen in terms of payouts and lawsuits and awards in the future? Is that all a concern?
Mr. Chair, Representative DeLaForest, absolutely, it's a concern from an insurance standpoint. Every year, for instance, when we I work also for our league's insurance program, which insures 800-some cities. Our reinsurers, who are national players, specifically ask questions about, you know, what's in place at the state level in terms of municipal liability limits. Have there been court decisions challenging them? Have they been upheld? Because they, frankly, are concerned about the integrity of the liability limits. And so, yes, I mean, as I said, neither from our parochial standpoint, neither piece of legislation is perfect. It does raise questions, but we believe that, again, the more defensible is one that includes a cap, which is consistent with current law.
Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one follow-up question. I've dealt with this issue in other committees with respect to completely different issues, and I'm curious, is there a great deal of concern? Is there a little concern? Can you assess the degree of concern? For example, there have been some areas where we've been considering changes, and those who participate in the particular market have said, we may not even participate. And I'm just curious, what's the degree of concern from reinsurers and the like with respect to the legislation we're considering, either with respect to the Senate or the House position?
Mr. Chair, Representative DeLaForest, from the perspective of reinsurers, it's not, frankly, a question of whether they're going to probably rewrite insurance for us. The question is how much they will charge us for that. So, they're very, I mean, they base their premiums, their assumptions, their underwriting based on the vitality of existing limits. So there's concern, but they'll take care of those concerns by increasing pricing.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a short response to Representative Winkler's comments. The Senate bill does make some changes in existing law. That's quite true. And I think the question then becomes, what's the rationale or rational basis in legal terms or constitutional terms for those changes? As I said at the outset, I think there's an adequate rational basis for changing the aggregate cap because of 187 or 82 people that were on the bridge rather than five or six that might have been otherwise able to fit within the ordinary aggregate cap. That's just an extraordinary difference. But in other analytical respects, it's still a tort claim. It's not an act of God. It's not a tornado. It's not a flood. It's not an earthquake. It's not a snowstorm. People were involved somehow, somewhere, from some direction in either acting or inacting in causing this event. That's a tort. That's the definition of a tort. Some actor fails to act the way they're supposed to. And so that we can't change by drafting legislative findings. That's just the reality. The Senate bill makes incremental changes with regard to the individual cap. The House bill eviscerates it, the individual cap. It ignores it, pretends it doesn't exist, and we just don't think that that's a that you can draw a rational basis for doing that. Representative Kahn?
Well, the closest analogy to this in our recent history that I can think of is the 9/11 incident, which obviously even dwarfs this incident. Why, in the 9/11 case, did the federal government decide that that wouldn't just be considered an ordinary airplane accident? Or why should people be treated differently there than the people who were treated in who are treated in airplane accidents or so forth?
Well, interestingly, Representative Kahn, Ken Feinberg, the special master for the 9/11 fund, in his testimony before the Joint House-Senate Subcommittee on Claims, couldn't explain that either. He said he didn't think it should have been treated the way it was treated. He thought we ought to be treating this as a tort claim and just go about the business of getting it settled quickly. In that case, there were national security issues. There were little allegations that the government had done something wrong. If it was private airplanes that were involved and private buildings that were hit. But there were great concerns about the economic viability of the transportation system if there were massive lawsuits against the airlines. There were foreign policy considerations that he explained were involved, a message to the world that we're not going to take this kind of attack. So there were a whole lot of other issues involved, and the Congress made an open appropriation on that one, too. So they're very different national and international circumstances and very different facts underlying that. But interesting that the administrator said he had trouble distinguishing it from that. And from his view of this incident, it should be treated as a tort and dealt with in that context. Any other questions for Mr. Grundhofer? Thank you.
Thank you.
And I should recognize Ken Solem and Grace Schwab are also here from their respective organizations, the School Boards Association and the Township Association as well. And I don't see Keith Carlson here from the Inter-County Association today. Thank you for your presence. We're now going to ask Chris Messerly to speak. Chris is an attorney representing a number of the victims of the bridge. We've asked him to come here to speak on narrowly to the issue of subrogation, specifically as it applies to ERISA and attempts to get some of the ERISA lien holders to agree not to pursue those liens. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Messerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Again, it's Chris Messerly. The last 26 years, I've been with Robbins, Kaplan, Miller, and Streese, and I lead a group of 20 law firms providing pro bono representation to about 100 of the bridge victims. And I'll comment briefly on the law as I was asked to, and then kind of give some facts about what we've been doing with regard to subrogation. I think many of you are aware of subrogation, just the body of law that allows typically an insurance company to get money back that they've paid to others. And in the bridge case, there are three general areas of subrogation. There are the auto insurance companies who paid out money on auto policies for the folks on the bridge. There are workers' compensation companies who paid out money for those who happened to be on the job at the time of this tragedy. And I think the one we've talked the most about, there are health insurance companies who have paid out a great deal of money. The subrogation issues apply principally just to the injury cases, because for the folks who have lost a loved one, there aren't payments for which there are subrogation rights. I do recognize, I think uniformly in both bills, that there's a recognition that a goal to get money to the victims rather than insurance companies. And we have spent a great deal of time trying to facilitate that goal, because it's our obligation to our clients anyway. And there are two general issues we've had to look at. Some of those subrogation rights are under state law. The state of Minnesota law governs the rights of those companies to get their money back. That I don't think is a concern for us or people in this room to accomplish the goal, because it's my view, I think it's widely recognized, that the legislature would be entitled to affect those state law subrogation rights. In other words, if the legislature said that for those state subrogation rights, those could be taken away by legislative act. That's not true, and this is the issue that we've been most concerned with, and I'll talk a bit more about. The subrogation rights governed by federal law that we've heard ERISA. I suspect that there's not a lot that any state can do to overcome the federal law rights, but there are certainly a lot of things that can be done. One thing that can be done is the language in both the House and Senate bills helps in defeating those claims, and I'll tell you why in a moment. Also, there's a more practical way of getting rid of those ERISA subrogation rights, the federal law, so that the victims get the money and not insurance companies. And that is for me, as their lawyer, to ask them to waive their rights. And that's what I have been doing. I will tell you that many of the people on the bridge had ERISA policies. However, most of the time, those ERISA policies don't take effect, and here's why. Insurance, car insurance, paid first, up to $20,000. And for many people on the bridge, they didn't have that many medical expenses. So the ERISA plans didn't pay at all for an awful lot of people. So there is a minority of people on the bridge, and I'm speaking from representing a majority of the people on the bridge. I can't speak for everyone, but it's a good representative sample. There is a minority of people who have ERISA health care policies that paid over and above auto policies. And I should note, good news is that at least one major auto insurance company has publicly stated that they have no interest, even if the legislature were to allow them, they have no interest in seeking their money back, given the uniqueness of this tragedy. I have contacted many insurance companies, and first I contacted the ones with the greatest federal ERISA interest, which has the greatest rights to get their money back from the victims. You have probably all heard of Brad Coulter and his family. It's a family of four that were all badly injured. Paula Coulter alone has medical expenses of around $1 million. I'm sure it'll be way more than that in the future. That insurance company, which is through Brad's employer, is entitled to get their money back. However, their company has formally told me that given the uniqueness of this catastrophe, they will not seek to enforce their rights. Also, Mercedes Gordon, who you may have heard of, is a young woman who suffered terrible injuries, and her lower body is filled with metal in hopes of reconstructing her legs. She has hundreds of thousands in medical expenses. Her employer, Accenture, yesterday told me that they will not pursue their ERISA rights. And I do expect that the other employers, and I will tell you that there's probably about a dozen of the 100 or so people we represent, there's probably about a dozen ERISA policies over and above auto. So there's not that many to start with that apply in this case, at least as of today. They have told me that they are waiving their right for two reasons, and quite frankly, I think there's a third, and I'll say that one up front, even though they didn't offer it. I just think they're good employers, and they have a lot of compassion for their employees. So I say that in my view, of their principal motives. But because they have fiduciary duties under these ERISA plans, there are two things that make it helpful so that they can waive those rights. One is the language that's in both bills of some sort, and I won't break them out. But the language in the bills that attempts to defeat payments to insurance companies, they recognize that that would make it difficult for them, even if they wanted to pursue those rights, to make a recovery. That'd be costly, and therefore it gives them a good reason to throw in the towel, so to speak, on their ERISA claim. And also, they were not, quite frankly, concerned about precedent from their own standpoint. In other words, they could think, well, since we're doing this for these people here, maybe next time someone's in a car crash a year from now, they'll ask the same. And they really said they had no concerns whatsoever, recognizing that this was a once-in-a-lifetime event. So I guess that's a factual statement of where things stand now. And it's good news. I think it says a lot for these employers because they want to see their employees, these victims, have the money rather than themselves, their plans, because they're self-funded. So that is really the status of things today, and we will continue to work with those other employers. And I should also note, at a previous hearing, I believe it was a House hearing, it was a long time ago, the administrators, Blue Cross and others, publicly stated that they had no interest in pursuing a subrogation rights, even though they may be entitled to under federal law. But they acknowledged, as I do, because it's these are self-funded programs by the employer, like my employer, my firm has the same kind of thing, it's the employer's decision, not the company they hired, like Blue Cross. They just administer it. So the news so far is good in what we're doing to accomplish the goals, I think, of both bills to get the money to the victims rather than the insurance companies.
Mr. Messerly, first of all, would you please keep us up to date as you reach conclusions with additional ERISA lien holders so that we can keep track as we're dealing with these issues?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to do that.
Thank you. Senator Schott?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Messerly, thank you. When you started and when you ended, you didn't really confuse me, but I think that there's some misunderstanding in the media about who are the big bad insurers that want to impose their subrogation right or exercise that right. But it really isn't the insurance company, right? It's the company that you work for who has your ERISA plan. And I just want to, not for your edification, because I know you understand that, but I think it's important that the public understands it's not, you're probably not negotiating with the insurance companies on that issue of subrogation. It's with the employer of the person.
Yes, Mr. Chair, right. Senator Scheid, yes, you're exactly right. It's most of us who work for a company, like my law firm, we self-fund our program for all of our employees nationwide, and we hire Blue Cross Blue Shield just to administer that. So you're exactly right. It's the employers who have to give the nod, and Johnston's and Accenture, hats off to them for doing that here.
Thank you.
Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Messerly, is everybody that was, I will say, badly injured, has huge medical bills, in the situation where their company that they work for, their health insurance, is self-insured, and as opposed to many, many people who are not self-insured, have a contract with the insurance company itself. And the insurance company, not the employer, would be the one who would have, as I understand it, the right to have that subrogation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, it is not the case that most of the people seriously injured have this ERISA issue. I'll give you an example. There are at least a dozen people, many of whom are very seriously injured, who were on the job, and workers' compensation policies cover that. That is not a federal issue. That is purely a state of Minnesota issue, and I think it is the view of most lawyers that the state, this body, would have a right to pass laws impacting state programs like workers' compensation or auto policies, for that matter, because those are state policies not governed by federal law.
Mr. Messerly is part of the complication here that ERISA plans under federal law have a right to recover the first dollar recovered by a victim, whereas the state-regulated plans or work comp, they don't get to apply for subrogation until after the victim has received full compensation for their losses. So it's last dollar.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't. If I may follow up, I don't think the question on workers' comp I understand, but I don't know if we have answered the question of someone who was not on the job, that had a private insurance company, and was seriously injured. Are we able to deal with that subrogation?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg. Yes, sir. Because if it's a private. If I just went out and bought insurance, health insurance from a company, not through my employer, that would be governed only by state law. The only reason these are governed by federal law is that they're through employers under a federal program. So my point is, anything that's not ERISA, the state can deal with in legislation because it's state law. It's these minority of cases that we are picking off one by one that we're concerned with, and so far we're in the direction towards alleviating any issues with those.
Can I just have a clarification for myself? Are those only that are self-insured, or many insurance employers are not self-insured, but by insurance? Are we able to deal with that?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg. Yes, sir, in two respects. I mean, we have to look at each policy to see whether it's truly an ERISA plan, a federal plan, or whether it's a state plan. And if it's not self-funded, it's a state plan. And the legislation can impact that.
Thank you for that clarification.
And then in addition to that, whatever we deal with in legislation, existing state law says the victims have to receive full compensation before they can even start to get their subrogation. ERISA gets to take the first dollar out. Senator Moy, I know you had a question, your hand up. Senator Schott.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I hope she'll leave so that she won't know that I didn't ask her question properly. Senator Moy and I, by just naturally, of course, I'm curious as well, if you've done any analysis on third-party tortfeasor claims here and of... and we were looking, or she was looking, on the analysis we had yesterday from Mr. Massman. On page 3 there, where there's a little box that says individual settlement offers equals total damages minus the collateral offsets plus the emergency payments plus tortfeasor payments up to a maximum of $400,000. And I probably need clarification of that, but if you could expand on that question.
Mr. Messerly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, yes, this gets in a little different area, but by all means, I think any lawyer who's representing anyone on a bridge has hired experts, and we're all looking very, very closely at who else may possibly be responsible for this tragedy. And I think any of us who are representing these folks are faced with the frustration that the NTSB has been totally unwilling to share with any of us any information. They've given us some, but I don't think anyone can come to any competent decisions or conclusions as to these other tortfeasors until the NTSB shares with us. I mean, we've asked them just for pictures, no touch inspections, and they've told all the lawyers, no, we're not going to give you anything at all. We're not going to have a public hearing. So we're all a bit frustrated by, and for that reason, I don't think anyone can truly answer what is an excellent question. Sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? I know we told the House members we'd get them out by 9:30 so they have their finance committee. Representative Winkler?
They can blame me, Mr. Chair. I just have
House members can blame you.
Exactly. Exactly. A quick comment. Mr. Messerly may want to respond. But with respect to third-party tortfeasors, I believe under both bills, the structure is that the state will make essentially whether it's a settlement or a compensation payment to the survivor. And the state then can pursue the survivor's claims through its own stepping into the shoes of those individuals and pursued those claims against the third-party tortfeasors. And the state can then seek to recover whatever we can to compensate ourselves for the fund that we're establishing. So either way, those claims can be pursued. And the question is, do you put the burden on the individual individuals on the bridge to pursue those claims against the third parties, or do you put the burden on the state to do that?
Representative Winkler, Mr. Messley, and all that gets into complicated legal issues of Perringer releases and who ends up stepping into which shoes to pursue claims. But I think both bills do at least reserve the state's legal right to recover its payments out of any third-party tortfeasor payments. I know that all the lawyers are looking carefully at third-party claims. There's been a lot of media recently about, Boeing of gusset plates whether the consultants may have missed that when they looked at the bridge and whether they missed information on the Ohio Bridge collapse, which was a similar design and issue, and the NTSB had looked at that as well. So I know there's been a lot of media about contractor loading up certain sections of the bridge with many tons of material as well. So there's going to be a lot of back and forth on this, still an open question. I think there might be a difference between the Senate and the House bill on how exactly this is treated. I'm not sure, maybe at some point we can get into this, is whether the House bill has a first dollar recovery from third-party tortfeasor payments in the Senate bill. I think we specifically put a provision in that says we get paid last after the victims get full compensation, even from third-party tortfeasors. Only then does the state have a right to step in to try to recover its payments. But in any case, I think that, seeing no further questions, that concludes the testimony in this point.
Thank you.
Mr. Messerly, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to recess now to the call of the chair, but we're anticipating around 3 o'clock because there are House Finance Committee meeting, the Senate's going into Finance Committee around 11 o'clock, and there's some other competing commitments midday as well. So when we reconvene, it's our intent to start with Ms. Gruber from MCHA, and then we will turn to our House and Senate counsel for more information as well. Thank you. We are in recess.
Okay.
Staff take care of it.
Yes.
Yes.